Well, it's 11 o'clock on a Thursday. Snow's coming down. Well, it's actually starting to taper off. A little wet mush out there. Get the Huskies ready. Green Zine is on here at WFVR-LP, South Royalton. Henry Swayze joining me in just a minute. But, hey, let's take a minute or two to listen to Leo Kottke and a piece called Owls. Green Zine this morning is brought to you by the that moving solar company out of Norwich. They're called Soleflect, also Building a Local Economy, a.k.a. Bale. Find out more about them at balevt.org. Tom Wells in Royal Trail Works. Tom informing me that the NCAA National Nordic Ski Championships will be happening on early March. I think it's the 4th, 5th, and 6th right down in Lebanon at the Oak Hill area. Daniel Leibowitz, longtime supporter of this radio station, and our very first treasurer, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, and there's a little bit of breaking news there. We'll just remind you of the dates later on. It's not until August. White River Land Collaborative, just across the Royalton-Tunbridge line. Just go across the Howe Bridge and you're there. And finally, Wit and Grit in Randolph, Vermont. I'm going to bring this down in the mix and save it for the end of the show and see if Henry is with us from the Queen City. Good morning, Henry.
I am.
I like it when the technology works. Yeah.
It's awful. It makes life much better when it's working.
Well, for people that aren't in the studio, if you wanted to know, and we don't use all of these buttons, but if I had to give you an average of how many buttons I can reach with my left and my right arm, it's between 175 and 215, I think. Yeah. But we only use about 25 of them. So, but anyway, we're on. It's a snowy day. It's a great day to be in Vermont, and we've got a pretty packed show, Henry.
We do indeed. A doubleheader today again.
Good job. So why don't you tell us who our first guest is going to be in, about 20 after, a quarter after? We're going to talk to Becca?
Yeah, 20 after.
Okay.
We maybe can call her a bit early, but she's so somewhat limited on her time.
She is.
So it's Senator Becca White, and she's at the legislature doing legislative business. So I told her 20 after. And she is the representative for Windsor 1, I believe it's called. And that includes South Royalton and probably Bethel and much of our FM listening zone in Windsor County.
That is true. In fact, the three representatives, Becca was reelected, Allison Clarkson was reelected, and then we have a new senator from Windsor County, basically taking the spot when Dick McCormick stepped down. And we hope to have Dick McCormick on the show here, or maybe his own show sometime during 2025, if you're listening out there, Dick. But Joe Major is the third senator from Windsor County. So looking forward to talking to Becca a little bit later.
Yes. And just as a lead-in to Bird Note. So and then second guest later on in the show will be Lindsay Brand, excuse me,
mm-hmm.
Who is the communications director for NOFA, and the NOFA conference is coming up Saturday and Sunday, sort of intense workshops on Sunday and general workshops on Saturday. I think the weather might work for the Saturday ones. Burlington is not forecast to get as much snow as the South Wilton area, so maybe even Sunday will work fine for them.
Yeah, maybe the hardcore NOFAites that are going up there on Saturday can book a room somewhere or bring their camper or something and just weather whatever snow you get and then hang around for those more intensive workshops on Sunday.
Right. Although those hardened NOFAites probably have animals to care for.
That is true.
That they have to go home to.
Yeah, I know the feeling, and we don't have quite as many animals as a lot of those folks probably do. I think we have four. Yeah, but that's good. They need care morning, noon, and night. Yep.
Yeah.
So we're going to be. Go ahead.
Yeah, as a lead in to Bird Note, I wanted to. I picked this out because it's a real explanation that change doesn't happen because of science. Change happens because of the public taking an interest in something. Hmm. And so this is a general encouragement about finding things that you can have a passion for and to take an interest in society, and it doesn't have to be birds. In fact, whatever gets to you is what you should be chasing. And I think that's the way change happens. So this is armament for change. So we're going to hear about owls from this. This is an old broadcast from 2013, so probably maybe just after the spotted owls had their impact.
Right. I just finished a book where spotted owls were kind of playing a role. But let's go to Bird Note, and then I've got another little tidbit about owls as well. This is Bird Note, and it's a very good-looking owl there. Henry, we'll be right back after this.
This is Bird Note. Denver Holt, founder and president of the Owl Research Institute in Western Montana, reflects on more than 30 years of field work with the birds he admires.
You know, I think when I initially started out, it was all about science, you know, and getting your papers out there so that research managers and conservationists, it was available to them to make the decisions they needed to make. And then as you progress and get a little older, you realize, it's not just really about science, it's about people. And so we try to get our publications, our information out to the public as well. Because in the end, it's, you know, the public who votes. It's the public who want interest in conservation. And the other thing with owls, because they're so high profile and because they're so admired by so many people, and you can get people to, you know, to protect owls, to, you know, to vie for conservation of owls, to say, yeah, let's protect that habitat because it's really important to these species of owls.
To learn about opportunities to participate in the work of the Owl Research Institute, begin at birdnote.org. And by the way, that's Denver making the calls of boreal and eastern screech owls.
I wish I could make an owl call like that.
Yeah, I think that might have been a real McCoy rather than someone mimicking it.
I don't know. I think Denver's got it, and he did several different ones there. Yeah, that was impressive, Henry.
So the The screech owl is here in Vermont, and it's capable of picking up a 10-pound animal.
Wow.
So it only weighs 2.5 pounds.
Another reason to keep your cat inside. Yep.
Yes. It's getting right into small cat territory.
Yeah. So we often talk about save the birds from the cats, but this is a case of save the cat from the bird. Yeah, keep the cats inside. Yep.
So Jane and I were out for a drive looking at water birds actually day before yesterday. And we were on the road to the Champlain Ferry at Shalott. And we were coming down a sweeping turn into the Shalott waterfront. And there was an owl sitting up on the power lines, on the heavy cable stuff. And Jane spotted it. I didn't see it. And she said, well, that was an owl. And I said, well, let's go back and look at it. And we went down to the bottom of the road, turned around, came back up, didn't see it on the way up, came back down again, and now it was there right where we'd first seen it. And it was had good visibility behind. It's pretty low-speed road. We put our four-way flashers on and pulled over and watched this owl for perhaps 5-7 minutes. And a car, we were pulled over to the side of the road, but a car came up behind us and paused for a moment, and then it pulled by us and then thought, well, maybe they're in trouble, and backed up and said, rolled down the window and said, hey, do you need help? And we said, no, we're looking at the owl. And they said, what? An owl? Mm-hmm. And they'd missed it as well.
Oh.
So, but they were quite taken. So we were had two cars wide in the cars.
Yeah, that's
in
good.
In the roads, checking out owls.
You know, probably
and
about...
That was a barred owl. And it was facing away from us, but it turned around and faced us head on. We had our binoculars with us, and it was very close. It wasn't fazed at all by cars parked right underneath it in the road.
Wow. Yeah, well, I'm glad it didn't get mushed in the road. So I've got something about that in just a moment. It does have a happy ending, but probably a week or 10 days ago, and it was dark, so, and I don't think it was the morning. I think it might have been more like 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. I opened the door onto where we enter our small place in Tunbridge, and there was a sudden movement from a low branch in a tree only about 20 feet away. And it was more of a sound and a sight because it was dark, but I have no doubt that it was an owl that was sitting there, and most likely there are critters, small critters, that often are burrowing along in the snow. And I guess I spooked the owl, and it went away. But owls made the front page of the Herald, the White River Valley Herald is a media under, we have a little sharing agreement with them, and on the front page, a story written by Kyan Smith and Tim Calabro, and it involves an alumni of this radio station, injured owl, and this is a barred owl, safely released in Randolph, and that release just happened the other day on February 10th. And the owl was discovered near the Pleasant View Cemetery in Randolph by the Buzzbin. For those of you who have listened to this radio station a long time, you know that the host of that show is Courtney Collins, and she works just across the parking lot at the Vermont Law and Graduate School. And she was driving to work, I think, and then she noticed this sort of half-fluttering large bird by the road, and she and a friend were able to put on, or I think her friend put on, a heavy pair of gloves, which apparently got shredded as they transported the owl in a box down to Vins, and we all know about Vins down there in Queechy. And just to give you a little more background in case you're not familiar with them, it is the Vermont Institute of Natural Sciences, and it's the home of a robust wild bird rehab center. And the staff took the Randolph owl, this is about 3 weeks ago, and they diagnosed it with a mild blunt force trauma to the head, impaired vision, and a slight shoulder injury. The Owl spent about 3 weeks at Vins, and just the other day, on February 10th, they told Courtney and some other locals they were going to come and release the owl at the Pleasant Valley Cemetery. And they did, and the bird promptly flew up in a branch and started staring down at them. So we have a healthy barred owl returned to the wild. So thanks to Courtney and her friend.
Yeah, that's special, paying it forward.
Yeah.
So owls mate for life, and they maintain the same territory. So bringing that owl back to where its home ground was a perfect thing to do. And on Swayze Road, by 47 Swayze Road, we used to have a bird feeder, and a barred owl that hung out at that bird feeder, going after the rodents that would come along and try to collect the seed under the snow that had fallen from the bird feeder. And it's now been many years, probably longer than the lifespan of that owl, but I still hear a barred owl there in that little cut that Swayze Road travels up when I'm at my house 1,500 feet away from there. So apparently the offspring have taken up habitation there as well.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. So it's about 17 minutes past 11. We could probably squeeze in one more tidbit before you make your phone call, Henry.
Yeah, I've got a tidbit. So we looked up, Jane and I looked up about owls when we saw this owl. And owls swallow their prey whole. And their digestive tract grinds up the bird or rodent or whatever it is they've caught. And not all of it will pass through their digestive tract, and they make pellets of it. Their gizzard rolls up tiny, hard pellets of bone fragments and things that their digestive tract didn't digest, and they cough them up. So you can look around for pea-sized balls of bone fragments that have been processed by an owl. And thinking about other animals that eat their prey whole, snakes do that. And the snakes actually digest everything, bones and the whole lot, except for feathers. And I guess they have to spit up the feathers. But but snakes, instead of being in their digestive tract for just a day or two or three, are there for as much as a month or more.
Wow.
So their stomach acids have the option to totally dissolve bone structure.
Yeah, I could see how that would happen. It would take a while to do that. So get your game cam ready, and if you can get a shot of an owl coughing up bone pellets, you'll get a blue ribbon here from Greenzine.
I put a link in the show for cumulative nouns, groups of birds, and there are marvelous names for different things, like owls is a I'm totally spacing my word dictionary. Parliament of Owls is one of the ones, but one I like the best. And a lot of collective nouns, the link I put up points out that this is kind of has a connection, a poetic connection to these groups. It isn't just about grammar. It kind of brings in a feeling that is being emphasized as well.
Right, I like that. And that is very egalitarian. Now, I don't know how often you would see a big group of owls together, But a parliament of owls, they're probably pretty good decision makers.
Yes, I think good decision makers. I've never seen more than one owl at a time. The picture in one of the pictures that we looked at when we were researching them showed three owls. I bet they were young ones.
Yes.
All sitting together.
Yeah, waiting for dinner to come home. Yeah, I'm going to let you go. Speaking of, a parliamentarian, we're going to talk to legislator Senator Becca White in just a moment. Henry, I'm going to let you go, and I'll bring you back in just a moment. And folks, you are listening to Green Zine. It's 21 minutes past the hour of 11 o'clock. And as Henry said, we've got a very busy show. So while we take a minute for Henry to make that call, I've been in touch with Senator White about a different issue. And in front of me, I have a number of bills that she is either co-sponsoring or sponsored initially. And we're going to be talking about some of those bills. One of the bills that I was talking to her about, and I'll just call it Senate Bill 4, that is its actual name. You don't need to know the topic, but if you're interested in the topic, that's what you would search for, Senate Bill 4. But what I learned from her, and I actually was in a judicial setting, I was sitting in the Superior Courtroom in Chelsea, waiting for the judge to come out and tell us whether we were going to have a jury draw or not, so we were free to read or talk on our phone or talk with each other. So I did talk to Senator White for a bit. And the process of getting testimony before a Senate group, she is a member of she's actually the co-chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, is very important. Sometimes people get heard, written testimony, direct testimony by sitting in the committee room about, a position. And I'm talking about citizens, not the lobbyists are there. If it's an important bill for a big company, et cetera, they're there, they're being paid, and they have very nice suits. But the common person can, if they feel strongly and have a lot of information to provide, can try to get on the list of either written testimony or in-person testimony. And depending on the weight of that testimony, it could possibly move the bill through an individual committee. And then it would probably move over to the entire Senate. Now, this is the process. I don't quite get all the way, but I know the main thing is that the bill, if it's going to actually have a chance to be voted on at the end of the session, has to make it over to the other side. And in this case, from the Senate over to the House. And then the House would consider the bill, possibly make some changes. And then if the bill makes it through there and there's some consensus, then it would be voted on by both bodies and presented to the governor. So that's just kind of a quick thumbnail sketch of what happens. Let's see if Henry's been able to get a hold of Senator White. Henry, are you there with Senator White? And sounds like the answer is no, but we're going to be back with him. I am prepared here. What I'm going to do is a recent issue. It is the January, February, March issue of Green Energy Times. And I'm just going to tell you about just kind of read from the table of contents. This paper is available lots of places, basically at South Royalton Market, over at the bank here in South Royalton. I think they have them at Coburn Store up in Chelsea outside of Freeverse Farm, probably at the local hardware store, etc. So as I turn pages to get to the table of contents, which is hidden in here. Well, I'll read you what's on the first page. This isn't surprising. We just had one of our hottest years ever. World breaches warming limit. And it's a story written by Martin Wall. And it talks about what is the cost to the U.S. economy as we keep breaking heat limits. There's a picture of the wildfires out in California, pretty dramatic, with a cityscape in the foreground and what seems to be a wall of flame approaching. What does the future hold for EVs? We're going to be talking about EVs and the status of the charging network in Vermont towards the end of the show. Now let's see if we've got Henry. Henry, are you there? Sounds like you're
there. Am I on with you?
Yeah, you're on now.
Okay, so Becca's not is tied up somehow. She's answering her phone. I'm going to text her and see if I can get her paying attention.
Okay, yeah, she's busy. So I'll let you go again then.
Yep.
All right, there we go. The wonders of live radio. Yeah, we like doing this without a net. So that's what's on the front page, and I still don't have there's some ad stuff. You know what I'm going to go to? I'm going to go to a local story. I can tell you this, in the Green Energy Times, the town of Putney, Vermont, which is south of here, also was able to get some, I don't know if it's MRPA funds, but they were able to get some money for putting in solar array and backup batteries. And the backup battery part isn't happening in the town of Tunbridge. But additional solar panels are on the way. Last night, was it last night? No, Tuesday night, the select board unanimously approved going ahead and putting out a 10-point, well, I'll just read you the story from, or part of it, from Darren Marcy. It's on the front page of today's Herald. Tunbridge to seek proposals for town office solar project, and the proposed size is 10.7 kilowatt hours. Right now, there is a 4.5 array that already is in place and has been throwing off power for at least the last 6 months. The reason that Tunbridge can afford to do this, it's not coming from taxpayers. It's coming from the Vermont, at least local taxpayers, from the Vermont Municipal Energy Resilience Program, MERP, which Henry and I learned about and a whole lot of other people in towns here in East Central Vermont, maybe about a year ago. And we were sort of tracking that. And the town of Tunbridge did put in an application, and definitely a big tip of the hat to Marianne Karen, the grants administrator for the town of Tunbridge. The program, the MERP program, is aimed at energy efficiency improvements and will go a long way towards cutting down the amount of electricity that Tunbridge buys from the grid for its two most energy-intensive buildings. The rough cost of the existing project, as proposed, is about $43,000 or $44,000. The rest of the money of that $255,000 grant is going to weatherization efforts at both the town offices in Tunbridge and also the town hall. A key element to this, not only for the grant writer Marianne Karen and the select board, is the Vermont Law and Graduate Schools Institute for Energy and the Environment. Kurt Mayland and two different students have provided assistance during this 3 or 4 month process, and all of that pro bono. And right now they are helping to find an individual to oversee the energy efficiency improvements in those two buildings, as well as the development and construction of the solar project. So good news there. Just as far as other funding that may be available to your town, there are still some ARPA funds out there. You should check with your select board as to whether there's going to be another round of funding for various projects. And certainly here from GreenZine, we would highly recommend spending money on efficiency and renewable energy. Now let's see if Henry's been able to hook up with Senator White. You're back, Henry.
I've texted, but I haven't yet got an answer.
Okay. So, all right.
If you've got any more things you want to cover, go for it, and I will try her once again on the phone.
Okay, you go ahead and do that, Henry. I'm going to bring this down in the mix. And you know what? Rather than listening to me ramble on, which I am expert at, we're going to go back to Leo Kottke. Just can't get over those owls out there. as I mentioned before on Green Zine, I do get sent to my mailbox usually on Fridays, so it's the day after the show, so it's maybe slightly dated, but I don't think the billionaires have lost much money in the last week. And a story that led Climate Forward, that's the name of this piece, and it's written by David Gelles, last name is spelled G-E-L-L-E-S, and it's titled Billionaire Climate Champions Go Quiet. Now, we've been hearing about billionaires maybe more than we really want to. Here's what Mr. Gelles writes for The Times. Over the last decade or so, a group of America's wealthiest individuals, largely from the tech industry, became one of the world's biggest climate champions, pledging billions in highly public campaigns. Now we're going to roll out the names. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, committed $10 billion of his own money in 2020 to start the Bezos Earth Fund, a charity focused on climate and nature issues. I wonder if that exists anymore. Michael Bloomberg, the former New York City mayor, has put more than $1 billion towards a campaign to close coal plants and block petrochemical plants. Bill Gates, you know who Bill is, Microsoft's co-founder, poured billions of his fortune into Breakthrough Energy, an umbrella organization working to address climate change. Lorraine Powell Jobs created a foundation to promote climate solutions and said it would spend $3.5 billion. Mark Benioff, the co-founder of Salesforce, spun up an initiative to plant a trillion trees. That's a lot of trees. And big companies, big tech companies, from Google to Meta to Amazon, made ambitious pledges to reduce emissions and support clean energy. But over the past few weeks, it can just change on a dime. Many of these voices have gone quiet as President Trump has slashed environmental protections, promoted planet warming fossil fuels, and taken steps to dismantle American climate policy. So just a review, because it happens so quickly, every night, every morning, something different. On his first day in office, he took the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord, set in motion plans to open Alaska wilderness to drilling and mining, halted federal approvals for new wind farms, and told federal agencies to stop subsidizing electric vehicles, and paused approvals for renewable energy projects on public land. Since then, his assault on climate initiatives promoted by the Biden administration has continued. With the exception of Bloomberg, none of the leaders, including Bezos, Gates, Powell Jobs, and Benioff, have made statements opposing the Trump administration's actions. Silicon Valley's major tech companies that have committed to reducing their emissions have also been silent. And I think a lot of those folks were there at the inauguration. Let's go back and see if Henry's made a connection. Henry, you there? Well, nope. Looks like I'm going to continue to fly solo here on the radio. Yeah. We'll continue with this article. None of the executives that I just mentioned or their companies mentioned responded to requests for comment for this article. The silence from this slice of the billionaire, you know who in Vermont uses that word more than anybody else. Yes, our senior Senator Sanders. This slice of the billionaire and technology world was in line with the deferential posture of much of the rest of corporate America. Instead of loudly and vociferously opposing Trump, as was often the case during his first term in office, many business leaders across industries have opted to court the president or at least remain silent as he has upended not just climate policy, but foreign policy and the federal bureaucracy as well. Amazon, Meta, Microsoft, and Google were among the companies that donated $1 million to Trump's inaugural committee. Well, I guess that got him a front row seat. Companies and business leaders are going to find that they need to decide what their red lines are, said Aaron Kramer, chief executive of BSR. What does that BS part stand for? A group that promotes corporate sustainable efforts. I'm not sure they're doing that right now, is what he said. The muted response marks an about-face for these billionaires. In 2017, when Trump withdrew from the Paris Accord for the first time, many tech moguls spoke out against the decision. Mark Zuckerberg, withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement is bad for the environment, bad for the economy, and it puts our children's future at risk. Of course, he's the founder of Facebook, now Meta. Tim Cook, the Apple chief executive, wrote on Twitter back in 2017 that the decision to withdraw from the Paris Agreement was wrong for our planet. And Sundar Pichai, the Google chief executive, wrote on Twitter which of course doesn't exist anymore, that he was disappointed with the decision to withdraw. And then the guy we hear about from every day, Elon Musk, opposed to the move. Climate change is real, he wrote on Twitter in 2017. Leaving Paris is not good for America or the world. All right, we're going to try Henry one more time, and then we're probably going to just move on to our second guest. Are you back with me, Henry?
I've moved on to our second guest, and I have Lindsay Brand on the phone with us. She is part of the outreach committee for the NOFA conference coming up. So welcome to Green Zine, Lindsay.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. Looking forward to the discussion.
So, any change in plans? This is a Saturday-Sunday event in Burlington. Any changes in plan because of the forecasted snow, or are you full steam ahead?
We are still going forward with the conference as long as, you know, UVM is still allowing events to take place and the staff and presenters are able to show up safely. Then we'll continue with the event, the rain or shine event. And so far, we're hearing from everyone that they feel comfortable and confident that they'll be able to show up. Our keynote speakers think they'll be able to get here no problem. So we're going forward, although we always wonder if we'll lose a couple people to skiing on nice powder days like this weekend.
Oh, no. They would rather be up there at the NOFA conference. They could ski today and tomorrow. Yeah, they'll be there, Lindsay. Don't worry.
I agree.
Who is your keynote speaker this year? I haven't read through all the material. Who do you have coming in for the keynote?
Yeah, we actually have a keynote duo this year. It's Dania Davey and Tim Gibbons. Dania Davey is a lawyer, teaches a class in Rutt Law School, also started the Land and Liberation LLC, and so, you know, does some work in our neck of the woods, working with farmers and other folks on legal issues. And then Tim Gibbons is from the Missouri Rural Crisis Center, and they're doing really excellent work in Missouri, you know, building power in the farming community, getting things done in an exciting way. And they are friends and collaborators professionally as well. So they're going to give sort of a combo speech. They'll both be up on a stage at the same time and be speaking to us about grassroots efforts and what we can do in agriculture to get things done in their experience.
Mm-hmm.
So this conference, obviously, people who are wed to farming and the soil and even nature are, this is the 43rd year. I've been to quite a number of NOFA conferences over those 43 years. And it's a very passionate group. Talk to us some about how the work of NOFA actually affects the larger community, why they should care about what's going on, whether they're coming to the conference or not, what's up and why should they care and maybe support NOFA?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking. Well, we are an agricultural state, and so some people are participating in agriculture by being professional farmers and farm workers. But all of us have a role to play in the future of our working landscape, basically. And the ecosystem services that farmers provide, the ecosystem health that we all benefit from when food is produced in a sustainable and, you know, healthy way, you know, that impacts all of us in our daily life. And also food security as well. Like all the food that we eat came from somewhere, comes from a farmer. And particularly as we think about climate change and we think about other instability along the supply chain, we are all directly impacted by anything that impacts farmers. So, you know, farmers staying operational, staying on the land, being able to use good sustainable practices really benefits all of us. And, you know, they don't exist in a vacuum. They're doing that on the groundwork, but they're only able to do it if they have community support and, you know, a framework of support across the state.
Yeah. So in a sense, those people that tend to attend the NOFA conference are not just stewards of the land, but indirectly stewards of the environment because of the making soils have lots of organic matter and pulls down carbon from the atmosphere, as well as making the soils hold water. Any further thoughts in that territory?
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right, and it warms my heart to hear you say that, because I couldn't agree more. Farming is really an interesting intersection at a lot of other issues that people care about. You know, it's at the intersection of social justice, of you know, climate resilience, of food security, like I said. And so if you care about those things, you can put your a lot of effort and passion into supporting farmers and make a real impact there, because, again, they work at this intersection. And I'll also mention, you know, the conference itself is a conference for professional commercial farmers, but it is also for all these other participants in the food system as well. So if people are interested in kind of tapping into the agriculture side of Vermont more, whether, you know, you have a backyard garden or you have a couple chickens or you don't produce your own food at all, there's something for those people too. You know, you can learn just more about what's going on. Maybe you're interested in, you know, school lunches and you want to learn more about what you as a parent or community member could do to get more local food in schools. Maybe you're interested in policy and you want to learn how you could talk to your legislators and get your values seen on the state stage. So it's for anyone who feels like they want to participate more in agriculture, not just the people doing that great on the ground work.
Yeah, the workshops. There's a link in our GreenZine link already up on the GreenZine website that lists the conference, and it is pretty amazing how many workshops that there are. Fill us in just a little bit about the scope of all that.
Yeah, I think we have over 40 workshops slated right now, again, pending someone needing to drop out because of the incoming snow. And we try to have a good spread for, again, all of these people I've talked about. So we have, you know, Farm Financials 101, which is, you know, obviously really great for a professional farmer. But we also have Hunting Wild Mushrooms, which is great for anyone who's interested in procuring that for just themselves unprofessionally. We have Songs for Changemaking is a workshop that I'm really excited about. Our executive director, Grace O'Dell, is leading that one. And, you know, we'll certainly have a lot of farmers in the room, but it's just for anyone who, you know, feels called to movement work and wants to learn more about the history of collective song in building resistance movements. So I think that should be a beautiful space during the day, not always what you think of when you think of a conference singing in a group. And then we also can have some like kind of policy and advocacy related things in the mix too, so you can learn more about a particular issue. And then of course, tons and tons, you know, maybe, you know, 20 or so that are really specific about growing and livestock tending and that sort of thing. And some of those are still good, again, if you're growing on a small scale or not just for, you know, production scale farms. But they are also, you know, have the commercial farmer in mind for those more technical workshops.
Yeah, I've looked up one of the workshops here, and it's happening at 11 a.m. on Saturday, and this is a topic we've discovered, we've covered extensively on GreenZine. So the name of this workshop is Forests, Climate Change, and Carbon, and it's being led by Ali Kosiba from the UVM Extension. Very interesting that there's a discussion of forests, and of course, a lot of big farms have forests there. So I imagine that might be pretty well attended since it's such a burning, well, not burning, fortunately, but a really important issue in a heavily forested state.
Yeah, we have a lot of interest from our members right now in agroforestry. So I also expect that to be popular, and we're about to launch a cohort, a farmer agroforestry cohort, because we're seeing so much interest in the community. So people will get together for a year and learn from each other and implement new agroforestry projects on their farm. So we already have people who have, you know, integrated forests into their food production, and we're about to have a lot more folks who are starting to, you know, dip their toe into trees on the farm.
Give us a really quick description of what agroforestry is, just what that, I mean, people think of woods as woods and food production being out in the field. Tell us about a little bit of, paint a picture of what agroforestry includes.
Yeah, well, the beautiful thing about organic agriculture and practices like organic or like agroforestry is the distinctions between, you know, land for food production and land for any other sort of purpose aren't so distinct, which I think is great. That's what allows us to have really healthy ecosystems and what allows a sort of food growing system to be more sustainable if it's really intertwined with natural systems. So you can implement trees on your farm for a whole host of reasons, for creative, you know, new reasons that I don't even know about that people are starting to, you know, discover. But common practices include pasturing your or grazing your livestock on land that has a mix of trees and, you know, open ground, because it draws down more carbon into the landscape, and it also can provide health benefits for your animals. You know, they enjoy the shade, and you'll have healthier, happier animals, which means, you know, they don't require as much intervention, antibiotics, things like that, which in turn also creates a better, healthier product for the consumer. So that's something that we see quite a bit in Vermont, but we're also seeing people, you know, let the forest be interspersed with their vegetable farming as well, particularly people that grow perennial crops instead of annual crops. There's so many creative things that you can do if you sort of see beyond the industrial farming techniques that are, you know, popular today. There's a lot we can do with trees and creating a whole kind of functional ecosystem.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing how productive a piece of land can get when you start mixing animals, forest, plant crops all together. It's it really introduces a whole other buzz level or something.
Complexity. I agree. Beautiful.
Yeah. All right. And so tell us again about Saturday workshops and then the more intensive ones on Sunday. What might draw people to the ones on Sunday that are longer and more in-depth?
Yes, I'll describe kind of both and we'll get a good sense of sort of the difference. So Saturday is packed to the gills in terms of options. So like I said, we have over 40 workshops that are shorter, an hour and 15-minute slots. We have the big keynote speech that I talked about. We have music. We have tons of different tasting options for food. We have you know, a film showing yoga. The list goes on. It's totally kind of a festive experience. Sunday is a time to go really deep on a single topic. So instead of, you know, trying on a whole bunch of different things and building a whole complex schedule, Sunday is you're choosing one topic and you're sitting in it all day. The registration is separate, so you can register for Saturday or Sunday or both. People that are interested in Sunday are probably going to be mostly people who are involved in agriculture in a more professional sense, but not across the board. So we have one all-day workshop about no-till vegetable production. We have one about seed saving that could be relevant to home growers and gardeners as well. We have one about cut flowers that actually could also be well suited for people that have some garden space, but it will also be relevant to commercial cut flower growing. And then we have an on-site intensive that'll take place in Underhill. So those other three are still sort of classroom based at the University of Vermont campus. And then we have one about maple sugaring in a changing environment. So thinking about climate resiliency and maple production. And that's taking place at the Proctor Maple Research Center in Underhill. And that one will have a lot of rich information for sugarers, but it's totally open to non-professionals as well. There'll be, you know, syrup tasting and explanation of terms for people that are just learners that are curious to learn more about what our maple industry might look like as we adapt.
Great. I know when I've gone, it's been a few years since I've gone, but the last time I went my decision-making process for whether to go was to pull up all the workshops and to tick off the ones that I'd really like to go to and see if that turns into kind of a full deck of cards, something that fills the day. And then you say, oh, wow, this is something I can't miss, and pushes you over the edge. So
that's great. I do recommend, if anyone has their interest piqued, just to go look at the schedule of workshops. If anything else, it's just cool to see what people are working on out there. And you might see that, oh, actually, I could really imagine a super cool jam-packed day putting these different topics together.
Yeah.
And while on that subject, because I am looking at this just real plethora of workshops all day long on Saturday, then the intensives on Sunday, why don't you just give us a reminder of the website where our listeners can find that, Lindsay?
Yeah. Yep. So you can go to NOFA Vermont, NOFAVT.org/conference. Or if you go to just our normal homepage, it should be pretty easy to navigate to the conference from there as well.
Excellent. Well, I hope that a lot of folks show up regardless of the weather, because, boy, there's a lot to learn. And I notice a real, despite what's happening at the federal government level, still a focus on DEI within the farming world. A lot of workshops, and during lunch, I see several topics that are definitely trying to make farming accessible to those who are either having farmland taken away or who are being discriminated against. So that's good to see. That's part of NOFA this year.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, there's plenty of good work that still needs to be done, and we're committed to doing it.
Excellent. All right, well, thank you for joining us today on Green Scene.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to talk about the conference at NOFA Vermont with you all.
Excellent.
All right. Keep up the good work. You're building community while you're building soils and all the other food supply and social justice. It's a marvelous Rubik's Cube that NOFA works on.
Thank you so much. It means a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, Henry, we've got about 8 minutes to go in the show. I am holding this fresh copy of the Green Energy Times, and I'm not going to necessarily read a lot from it, but I do want people to be aware. And I do know an older gentleman in Tunbridge who has really benefited. We talked to a representative, Capstone, probably a couple of months ago, and the number of programs they offer for low to moderate income Vermonters who need to weatherize their house, have an energy audit done, the blower test, whether it's insulating the roof, doing something in the basement, getting recommendation, and getting serious discounts depending on your income level. And some of these things may be being done at no cost. So there's a pretty thorough article here on page, what is the page number here? Yeah, page 25 of this current issue, once again, of Green Energy Times. You can look them up online and read it there. It's just greenenergytimes.org. Capstone's innovative programs stretch dollars and help meet Vermont's climate goals. So I believe they are still, you know, they're pretty maxed out. Some people are waiting for a while. I'm not sure of how much of their funding is tied to the federal government. We know a lot of federal funding that was going to projects like this is being shut off. So that would be a question you want to ask. There's a Capstone office in Randolph, and then their main office is in Barrie, Vermont. So once again, you can find that on page 25 of the Green Energy Times. Henry, before I go on.
Yeah, I remember when we interviewed the person from Capstone, they said that their funding was made up from many sources, and that, yes, there was federal money in there, but there was also a lot of grant money and so forth. So I'm sure that their programs will not disappear, whatever happens in Washington.
Yeah, so that's some good news there.
So
shall we get unplugged, Henry?
I will put a link to Capstone in our notes, to that article in our notes, so you can look at that.
So
I've asked Becca whether she's paying attention, has a chance to jump back in, and so far she has not responded to me. So
yeah, we'll
I think
her,
she's.
Yeah.
She's buried up to her her elbows in deep mud.
But, you know, since we were planning to speak with her, and hopefully we'll get to speaking to her before, I'm seeing if I still have this page which lists the bills that she is backing, and several of them are environmental bills, including the very first one, which is Senate Bill 5, an act relating to affordably meeting the mandated greenhouse gas reductions for the thermal sector through efficiency, weatherization measures, electrification, and decarbonization. Now, we have talked about that issue before, Henry, with, I think, somebody from VNRC maybe saying, well, the group that sued the state saying they are not crunching the numbers. They are not actually getting to the goal. So there is a bill that's doing some follow-up there. She's also sponsoring an act relating to the Clean Fuels Program. So these are things that we were going to be talking, and maybe in the future we will be talking with to Senator White about that. It's interesting to look down this list right now, and I don't know if there's a second page, but the Senate bills that she's been involved with, it looks like 145 of them on page one. Now, I don't know if those are all for this year, or maybe that's cumulative over the last couple of years. One thing that will not be voted on by the Senate or the Vermont government, because it's under the aegis, unfortunately, of the federal government, and that is President Trump has zeroed out the money that was going to support, it's called the NEVI network, National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure, that was started under the Biden administration. Some states have gotten some high-speed chargers in, and VTrans announced, so that's back to Vermont, announced back in December that it was awarding $9.3 million in federal funding to 11 public fast charger projects along the state's busiest highway corridors. That money is not happening. So basically, the statewide federally supported NEVI project is in abeyance at the moment. And a couple of those projects were going to happen in our listening area, or at least close by, one down in White River Junction and one in Randolph. But they have been halted by this stoppage from the federal government.
So is that money really gone away, or is it just the Trump administration trying to make it go away?
Well, let's see here. It says the Federal Highway Administration sent out a memo telling states to halt any work on NEVI, which was originally included in Biden's. The Trump memo, which covers about $5 billion in grants nationwide, told states not to move ahead on public EV charging. I don't know if it's open to people putting some pressure on, if that's possible, to get the money released.
So what we heard last week from our guest was that the Trump administration makes these pronouncements and people merrily take programs down when, in fact, the courts have already blocked them from doing it. So you got to look twice and sniff twice at all this stuff to find out what's real. And if it's something that the legislature has enacted into law, the Trump administration, by executive order, cannot take it down until the legislature has changed the legislation on it. So there's hope out there. Don't give up just because you heard something.
Yeah. So just on the more hopeful front, Barrett Walter, a clean technology project manager at Norwich Technologies, a major solar installer in our area, said he was holding out hope that the Trump administration would eventually release the funding and get the project back on track. Quoting him now, these chargers were ideally placed across key travel corridors in Vermont and would have certainly been a huge benefit to connecting Vermont to other states in the New England supporting EV travel. So a story to be followed up on as we go through the first few months of the new administration in Washington. Henry, we're getting down to 1 minute. I'm going to take a moment to thank our underwriters, and then I'll toss it back to you. You are listening to Green Zine here at WFVR-LP in South Royalton. This program is brought to you each week here at Thursdays at 11 a.m. for the last almost 12 years by the White River Land Collaborative, Wit and Grit, Soliflect, Bale, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, and Solar Fest coming up on the first weekend in August in Brandon, Vermont. Back to you.
Yes, so we will try to get Becca White to see if she's got space on next Thursday. She's obviously gotten buried somewhere. And the week after, we should have David Johnson as our guest, who has just published a new paper on how you do a triple win with bringing complexity into the soil in order to make bigger crops, hold more water.
All right.
Drawdown, etc.